This afternoon, what I'd like to talk about is a rather special topic rather than an ordinary sutta class. I'm going to give a more general overview of the Buddhist scriptures, especially like a historical and comparative view of the Buddhist scriptures. I'm going to be looking at questions like, where do they come from? What are the earliest scriptures? What form were they in? How did they evolve? How did we get the particular form of the teachings that we have now? How reliable are they? Which parts can we trust? Which parts can't we trust? Now, these kinds of questions. Now, many of you have probably been coming to sutta classes for a while. If you've tried reading any of the suttas in the Pali Canon, you'll know that there's a mass of material there, thousands, literally thousands of suttas. Many of them are enigmatic and obscure. Some of them are very straightforward. Some of them seem weird and a bit dubious. Some of them we look at and we think, is that right? Could the Buddha have really taught that? Sometimes we want to decide, yes, the Buddha taught this and he didn't teach that. That can't be an authentic sutta because we don't agree with it. Yeah, and This kind of situation is not particularly satisfactory. If we want to look in more clear way at these suttas, we have to get some kind of objective criterion, some kind of perspective that we can look and see where do we start? Where's our footing in these? We've got in this ocean of discourses, this ocean of teachings. So this afternoon, I'd like to talk in some detail about giving you a perspective. What I'd like to do, I've given a couple of talks on this topic before, and what I'd like to do is maybe divide the talk into two. The first half, I'll take maybe half an hour or so, and that will, I will talk about, basically what I'll do is I'll bring you up to speed on the generally accepted understanding of how scholars, Buddhist scholars and so on, are looking at the Buddhist scriptures. So I'm going to give you the basic background information on the historical and comparative situation as is generally accepted by most scholars. After that, then maybe we'll have a break for about 10 minutes because I'm going to be giving you quite a lot of information and sometimes it's a bit too much to take it all in. So I'll have a break for about 10 minutes if you want to have a cup of tea or something and then come back and then we'll go on with the second half. And in that second half, I will go more into more detail into some special theories which are being developed at the moment by a number of scholars, including myself, to give a quite radically new and different perspective on the whole question of the Buddhist scriptures. So this will be hopefully stuff which you have never heard before and stuff which you won't find in any books, all right? And stuff which the people who don't write the books, so the people who wrote the books don't know about, because a lot of these things are just coming out in research which has been appearing in recent years and wasn't really known about previously. So hopefully that will be very interesting for you, okay? So, when we look at the Buddhist scriptures, where do they come from? Now we know the general story, the Buddha was enlightened. He taught for 45 years. During that time, all of the sources attest that he must have been teaching very frequently. He was travelling around the place. He was probably speaking in different dialects in the different regions he would go to. He gathered a large community of monastic and lay followers for the purposes of the scriptures. The most important group, of course, was the monks, because it was amongst the bhikkhu sangha that the collection was collected and handed down. Now, in these communities, when the Buddha would go and teach there, of course, the monks would memorize certain discourses. The Buddha would, as is normal, teach the same things very often. Yeah, and I'm sure any of you would know that if you've been coming to the Friday night talks for a number of years. how many times have you heard about the two bricks in the wall? Yeah? And it's the nature of oral tradition, yeah? Now, if you got all of Ajahn Brahm's talks and every time that he told the two bricks in the wall story, yeah, and put them all in a collection, it would make a whole big thick book, wouldn't it, with telling all the two bricks in the wall story again and again and again. And you think, oh my goodness, isn't this unutterably boring? Yeah? But of course, that's what it is like with an oral tradition. You have to do that. And that's what happened with the Buddha's teachings. Yeah, he taught the same things over and over again. They became collected in books. And of course, we open them. We try to read them like we read an ordinary book. And of course, that's what we say. Oh my goodness, I have to wade through these masses of repetitions and so on, which come from the oral tradition. The process of collecting and memorizing those discourses would, of course, have been going on in the Buddha's own lifetime. Yeah, it was an ongoing thing. The teaching, memorizing, and of course remember that the oral tradition was very, very well established in India in the Buddha's time. I read a very fascinating story about that just a short time ago in a book by a fellow called Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff's book was full of rather unbelievable tall tales, but this particular tale had a ring of truth about it. His father was a bard in the oral storytelling tradition in the Caucasus region, like kind of central Russia, Asian region, in the Stans, what are now called the Stans. And he was one of the last of that generations of oral storytellers. And Gurdjieff recounts a story when he was a kid, and he listened up all night. His father was arguing with an Anglican priest about this particular tale that he remembered. And they kept on repeating this over and over and over again. And it was a tale, an ancient tale called the Epic of Gilgamesh, and it told a story of the flood. And Gurdjieff's father was arguing that this must have been an ancient Assyrian myth, which was the origin story for Noah and the flood in the Bible. And of course the Anglican priest was denying this. Now this conversation happened, I think, in the 1880s, and it wasn't till about 10 or 20 years after that that the archaeologists in Assyria dug up the clay tablets that had the Epic of Gilgamesh written on it. Exactly the same, with the same names of the gods listed in the same form as was recounted in the oral tradition. And that epic was about 5,000 years old. Yeah, 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And it had been passed down in the oral tradition for all that time. And from our point of view, we tend to think that if it's in the oral tradition, it must be unreliable. But in fact, not only is that not the case? I've never actually seen any scholar even try to argue that. Every scholar that I've read on the point has all agreed that the oral tradition is at least as reliable as the written tradition. In some ways it might be more reliable. So these discourses were collected, they were memorized. Yeah. Did he? Okay. Yeah, of course. Never going to be 100%. Yeah, you know. But the written tradition isn't 100% either, and we'll go into some of the flaws in the written tradition as well. I mean, see, one of the things with the written tradition, for example, is you can get a mistake will be included, and then will be copied down through the generations. With the oral tradition, because you usually will understand it when you're reciting, it will tend to be corrected. And also you would recite together with other groups of monks, so you can correct each other. So yeah, certainly it's not 100%, but it's not too bad. So even in the Buddha's own lifetime, there was some degree of specialization occurring. Some of the monks became more interested in studying the Vinaya, the monastic disciplines. Some more interested in studying the suttas, the Dhamma teachings. And so we read about in the earliest texts this division. The Vinaya students would stay in separate quarters, they had separate teachers. Dhamma students would stay in other quarters and have their own teachers. So there was a degree of specialization even in the Buddha's lifetime. As the Buddha got near his passing away, he told the monks that they should, after his death, they should get together and recite the teachings, and they should make those teachings a standard for what is Dhamma and what is Vinaya. And in as far as the standards of Dhamma are concerned, he would always say you should take as your standard is those suttas that were spoken by the Tathagata, Yepite Suttanta Tathagata Bahasita. Now this phrase is, I think, more pregnant and more specific in meaning than we usually take it to mean today. One thing we have to remember is that the word sutta in the suttas itself doesn't just mean any old discourse. So that whole collection of things we call the Sutta Pitaka, we have this whole collection of books, we tend to call that the suttas. In fact, when the word sutta occurs in that context, it cannot mean that collection as a whole, okay? Because a lot of that collection was obviously compiled later. What that word sutta refers to is those teachings spoken by the Tathagata, so specifically the teaching sections that are attributed to the Buddha himself. I'll come back to that a bit later on. So we have these collections, they were organized in various ways. Yeah. Not everybody could memorize everything, so there had to be a degree of specialization. They had to choose how to memorize it and how to organize it. One of the earliest classifications that we find mentioned very often in the Pali Canon, if you've read around the Pali Canon, you will have surely come across it, and it's called the nine-factored Dhamma, Navanga Dhamma, or Navanga Sattu Sasana, and that consists of the first three are the most important here, Sutta, Gaya, Vyakarana. I'll mention these in the Pali form so you can remember them. Sutta, yeah, literal meaning is thread. Gaya means song, and means like discourses with verses in them. And Vyakarana literally means answer, like, and it means like questions and answers, yeah? There are nine of these parts of the Dhamma altogether, but it seems very likely that these first three were the earliest collections. And in fact, there is one place in the existing Pali, in the Mahasunyata Sutta, and also in the Chinese version of the same discourse, where it mentions just these three. So again, I'll come back to this point later on. I'm sort of planting these seeds in your mind for now, so that you'll have the kind of concepts ready when we come back to them later. So when the Buddha passed away, the monks gathered together, they recited them. They came together at the First Council. Now, the accounts we have of the First Council were written much later than the Council itself. And what they do is they tell us the party line, okay? So the Theravadan version tells us the story according to the Theravadan school, which is, of course, that what was recited there was the Theravadan Pitaka, yeah, the Theravadan canon. The Sarvastivadin is another school. They tell us their version of events, and so on. Each school will tell us their own version of events. What actually happened, we don't really know. There certainly was a meeting. The monks came together that they recited the scriptures. What form those scriptures were in, well, that's a very interesting question. Maybe towards the end we might be able to answer that. Just to give you an idea of some of the differences, the Pali version in Theravada, of the Theravada school, tells us that the first discourse recited was a discourse called the Brahmajala Sutta. And that discourse is indeed currently the first sutta in the first collection of the Sutta Pitaka, that is to say, the version in the Theravada and Vinaya telling us about the First Council actually agrees with the existing canon as we have it. Another school, the Sarvastivada, tells us that not the Brahmajala Sutta was recited first, but that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the rolling forth of the wheel of the law, which was the Buddha's first sermon, it tells us that this discourse was the first one recited at the First Council. Now, of course, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? It was an obvious starting point. Let's start with the Buddha's first sermon. So when we look at these things, we can't simply assume that the versions presented to us by one or other schools are going to be correct. We have to look at how reasonable they are in context. Now, after the First Council, Buddhism stayed unified in India for a substantial period of time. none of the dates in this early period are settled. Basically, we don't know any date in India earlier than the invasion of Alexander, which was sometime after the Buddha. Nobody knows even to within 150 years when the Buddha's dates are. But most of the sources tell us that the first schism, the first division in the community, happened between 100 and 160 years after the Parinibbana. So that's not too bad, actually. Like, it's obviously a terrible thing that there was that schism, but given how widespread Buddhism was, very geographically far flung, different many followers, different languages, different communities, to actually stay unified for maybe 150 years was pretty good. But inevitably differences arose and schisms occurred. I won't go into details in the schisms now, but I'll just mention some of the important matters that are going to be essential for the discussion later on, particularly because they involve the schools of which we have existing scriptures, okay? So one of those schools, of course, is the Theravada. Now, that first schism divided into two schools, one called the Theravada, one called the Mahasanghika, okay? The Theravada, both of those schools later divided up again and again and again, totaling, traditionally, they say, 18 early schools of Buddhism. That ancestral Theravada school then divided up into many schools. So what we call Theravada today isn't really identical with that original Theravada in the sense that we're really kind of one subgroup of that original Theravada. Now remember that there's no a priori reason for thinking that any one of those schools has really got it any better or any more right than any of the others. The only reason Theravada has survived and the other early schools have disappeared was simply a historical accident. Theravada missions were sent to Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka survived the Muslim invasions many a thousand years later. Other missions were sent to the north and to the west of India, where they were decimated by the Muslim hordes. So they disappeared, not because their teachings were any inferior or worse, but simply because of the accidents of history. So we've had the first split into the Mahasanghika and the Theravada. Now that's interesting because what we can assume from that is that those things held in common between those two schools are likely to have predated the schism. And this is a very important historical and scholarly principle. Okay? So this schism between the Theravada and the Mahasanghika occurred, let's say, 100 years after the Parinibbana. So we can assume that those things held in common between the Theravada and Mahasanghika probably predated the schism. Now, that's not a hard and fast rule by any means, because there obviously can be, and there was, borrowing at later times between the schools. But as a general rule, it's one of the best principles we have. So the Theravadan school later split into two other schools, one called the Sarvastivada. So you're going to hear this word a few times, so I think you should get used to it. Sarvastivada is a Sanskrit word meaning everything exists, all right? And what their characteristic doctrine was that all dhammas of past, present, and future exist, all right? So, as you can well imagine, the philosophers and the theorists had a great fun for many hundreds of years trying to explain what this exactly meant. Yeah, Sarvastivada were a very big and powerful school in northern and northwestern India for many centuries. And they still have a lot of existent literature. Interestingly enough, we were just yesterday at the house of some of the Burmese followers, and there was pointed out to them they had on the shrine an image of a monk called Shin Upakul, and he is actually the patriarch of the Sarvastivadin school, who lived at the time of King Ashoka. And yet his worship, even though he's not Theravadin, his worship is spread out through the northern regions of Theravada in Burma, northern Thailand, Laos, and possibly Cambodia, northeastern Thailand, quite widespread. And yet he's actually from a different school. Possibly the Sarvastivada actually were in that area before the Theravada came there. So here we've got up to the Vibhajyavada and the Sarvastivada. The Vibhajyavada then split into two schools, one of which we know as Theravada, which is really the, I guess, the Sri Lankan branch of the Vibhajyavada, and the other group is called the Dharmaguptaka. Now notice that these split quite late, and they're very similar, okay? So the Theravada and the Dharmaguptaka are very similar. Now why I'm particularly mentioning these schools rather than the many others is because we still have large amounts of early material from these schools. So now this, I'll now introduce you to the topic of the comparative study of the Pali and especially the Chinese. What happened was all of those early schools, it seems, had their own canon. They had their own collection of suttas, of vinayas, of some kind of Abhidhamma material. They were collected originally in a language something like Pali, or a dialect of Pali. Later on, getting towards, say, around the time of Christ, some of the schools translated their Pali suttas into Sanskrit, into usually what they call Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, which is basically Sanskrit with a Pali accent. So they each had their own canons. Now, and then a few hundred years later, about 300 or 400 years, when the Chinese pilgrims started coming to India, they got hold of some of these collections and translated them into Chinese, and we still have some of these Chinese translations. We don't have any complete collections of other early schools of Buddhism available in Indian languages. There are a few scraps and pieces in Sanskrit or Prakrit or some other dialects, bits and pieces here and there. There's some Vinaya material and so on in Sanskrit. There's a small amount of early material available in Tibetan, about a dozen suttas of early Buddhism found in Tibetan, that's all. And the vast bulk of the material is found in Chinese. The Chinese have about half a dozen Vinayas from early schools. So that's obviously like a fascinating area for study. We can compare the Vinaya material from all the schools, and what that tells us very clearly is that the actual Vinaya rules followed by all the schools was basically exactly the same. There's very little difference in the Vinaya rules at all. We also have a large amount of sutta material, but unfortunately not as much as we have the Vinaya material. Now in Pali, the early scriptures that I'm going to focus on most of the time in this talk is the four, what in Pali we call Nikayas. In China, in the Sanskrit traditions, they were called Agamas. Okay? Now, as in Pali we have the Digha Nikaya, in Chinese we have the Dirgha Agama. And that belongs to the Dharmaguptaka school. So remember I told you that the Dharmaguptaka school was very similar to the Theravada school. Yeah? The schism was quite late, and as we would expect, those two Digas are very close. They're very similar. The Pali has 34 suttas. The Chinese version has 30 suttas. Of those extra four, two of them are found in the, not in the Pali Diga, but in the Majjhima. And two of the other ones are simply repetitions of material available elsewhere. So effectively, we've got the same group of 30 suttas in both collections. Those suttas are almost identical. They're very, very similar. I haven't been through a detailed comparative study of all of them, but of that material that I've seen so far is very, very similar between the two collections. We have the two Majjhimas in Pali, the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Chinese, the Majjhima Agama. And the Chinese Majjhima Agama is from the Sarvastivada school, which I remembered mentioned before is one of the largest schools. Yeah? Their Majjhima has 222 suttas, the Pali has 152. In fact, there's only about 98 or 99 suttas in common between the two collections. There's a lot of the other material which is found not in the Majjhimas but elsewhere. For example, there's 78 suttas which are found in the Chinese in the Majjhima, which in the Pali are found in the Anguttara Nikaya. Okay? So what we're talking about here is the movement of discourses from one collection to another. Okay? So it seemed like there was some ambiguity. They might have been put in one place or might have been put in the other. The actual doctrinal content is almost the same. but the arrangement and organization of it is largely different. So what that tells us is that the content of these suttas was largely settled in the pre-sectarian period before the schisms, yeah? Whereas the specific sequence and organization and structure of these was largely settled in the sectarian period. Okay? So that's quite an interesting finding. If we look closely at the two Majjhimas, let's say we ask ourselves, are there any hints that the sects have adapted and changed the text in order to fit in with their own particular sectarian bias? Yeah, we can have a pretty good idea of doing that, how to go about that, because we have some later books, especially the Katavattu in Pali, and some other books which discuss all the controversial issues where all the schools would disagree, and it gives you hundreds of different arguments on little points of Dhamma where the different schools disagreed with each other. So we know what the biases of each school was, and we know how they would be likely to try to change the scriptures if they were going to do that. The answer to that question is that there's very little difference and sectarian bias. There is some, but very small. So much so that it's actually very difficult even to identify which school these Chinese versions actually belong to. So I'm telling you it belongs to the Sarvastivadin school. In fact, some scholar has spent years going through the thing and identifying every little point and comparing it with the different sectarian positions, and eventually they've managed to conclude that it's probably the Sarvastivadin school. Now, some of the differences between them are just to mention how minor they are. One of the suttas in Pali has a discussion between Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahakasapa, in which they each call each other friend, like respect, avuso, like respected friend. In the Chinese version, Mahakasapa refers to Venerable Sariputta as friend, Sariputta refers to Mahakasapa as Bhante, Reverend Sir, which is a more respected title. Now, Mahakasapa in the Sarvastivadin school and then later in the Mahayana schools was regarded as the chief patriarch, and even so in the Zen and so on, he's regarded as the chief patriarch, even higher than Venerable Sariputta, whereas the Theravada regarded Sariputta as the highest patriarch. So that's a hint that they were putting Mahakasapa above Venerable Sariputta. So this is how refined we have to get in order to tell any sectarian differences between the two. There are other things which are somewhat more important. The Sarvastivadin version of the Four Noble Truths says that these Four Noble Truths existed in the past, they exist in the present, and they will exist in the future. So remember I told you that this was the characteristic doctrine of the Sarvastivadins, that all Dhammas, past, present and future, exist. So we here see this like an attempt to bring this doctrine into the suttas. So these are two Majjhimas. There's an excellent book by a Vietnamese monk called, I think it's just called the Chinese Majjhima Agama and Pali Majjhima Nikaya. I guess we've probably got a copy in the library there, which is a very detailed comparative study of the two, which I can highly recommend. Moving on to the two Sanyuttas. The Chinese Sanyutta, again, probably is Sarvastivadin. And the two Sanyuttas are, again, very close together. They each share a large mass of suttas in common. Again, we're in a similar situation where 90-95% of the main teachings are all the same. There's some differences in the settings, the organization, these kinds of things. And occasionally we see hints of an attempt to interpolate sectarian differences. Again, I can just give you one example here. Another one of the sectarian differences which became quite important was the idea of, does enlightenment happen like that, or does it happen gradually? Yeah, and if any of you are familiar, especially in Chinese Buddhism, this became a great controversy in later years, like sudden versus gradual enlightenment. Now, in this particular issue, the Theravadin school, very unusually for one of the early schools, decided that enlightenment happened instantaneously, whereas the Sarvastivadin school and most of the other early schools decided that it happened gradually. And so this is reflected in the Sanyuttas. The Theravada Sanyutta says that the Four Noble Truths are all realized at the same time, whereas the Sarvastivadin version tells us that the Four Noble Truths are realized one after the other. Yeah? So this is the kind of differences that we're able to discern. Again, you know, there's not much to it, really. I mean, does it really matter? Probably not. But this is where there's hints occasionally of some sectarian interpolations. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Especially with the early suttas, they tended to be translated earlier, and the translations weren't so good. With the Mahayana sutras, were translated later, and because they were much more popular, they did several generations of translations. So, for example, you know, like in English, we have the old versions of the suttas translations, which, if you've read them, are pretty hard going, and then Bhikkhu Bodhi's ones, which are so much better. With the Agamas, the early suttas, we didn't get those second generations. We've only got the first generation translations. So, yeah, there are quite a lot of translation issues. In terms of, like, specifically understanding, like, the particular, like, specific meaning of sentences and words and so on, then the Chinese can never compare with the Pali in terms of just its accuracy. I mean, you know how in Pali, uses like technical and psychological terms with a very precise and subtle meaning, and that really can't be captured in the Chinese very well. So we're it's as if we're kind of looking at it through a slightly fuzzy lens. We can't see those details as well, but we can certainly see the overall picture fairly well. Yeah, I mean, some of the issues, for example, one of the issues with translation. In the Pali Vinaya, in the Padimokkha, one of the rules for monks is that you can't damage plants. Yeah. Now, the word for plant in Pali is Buddhagama. Bhuta meaning a being, gama meaning a home. So, of course, beings live in plants, so you shouldn't be damaging plants because it's the home of a being. Yeah. But Bhuta can also mean ghost. Yeah. So the Chinese and Tibetan translations all have, for that rule, attacking ghost villages. Yeah. So it's against the Vinaya for a monk to attack a ghost village, but not for a monk to just pluck plants. So that's probably one of the reasons why in those northern traditions, the monks ended up being farmers. They didn't actually have a Vinaya rule against destroying plants. Yeah? As long as they didn't destroy any ghost villages, they were okay. What is a ghost village? Well, I think there's plenty out in the outback of Australia. Yeah. Yeah, like a ghost town. So then with the last collection, last of the four major collections is the Anguttara. Now the Sanskrit version is called Ekotara, basically means more or less the same thing. And this school is of the Mahasanghika, or probably one of the later offshoots of the Mahasanghika. So remember I said that the Mahasanghika was the first schism with the Theravada. So the Mahasanghika went off, and several sub-schools later down the line, some people think maybe a school called the Lokuttaravada, they produced what we have now as the Ekotara. That's certainly quite late, later than the other collections. For any number of reasons. I don't know of any detailed studies available on that particular collection. And it has relatively little in common with the Pali Anguttara Nikaya, only about 25% of the suttas in common. One of the reasons being that a lot of the material is simply found in the other collections. But this also does tend to hint that the Anguttara was settled and finalized in its form later than the other collections. So these are the four major collections which we have versions of in Pali and Chinese. Now, the study of these things is at a very rudimentary stage. Okay, there's only a handful of scholars in the world who can actually read Pali and Chinese. There's only all the books that have been published on that, as far as I know. There's one catalogue which just simply lists what's there and what isn't there. And there's one lengthy, full-length study on the two Majjhimas and one on the two Sanyuttas, and that's about it. So if you're interested in these kinds of ideas, I'd suggest that you get hold of these ones, especially on the Majjhima and the Sanyuttas, and have a look at them. The comparative study on the two Sanyuttas is excellent, and was done by a Malaysian scholar in the University of Queensland a couple of years ago, and was only published in 2000. So I'll just briefly mention the fifth Nikaya here in Pali is the Khuddaka Nikaya. Now this is agreed by all scholars to be later than the four Nikayas. It contains some early and authentic material, and it's fairly easy to identify which that is. The Khuddaka Nikaya as such doesn't exist in the northern traditions, although some of the texts that are found in that are found in the northern traditions. For example, you have like Chinese and Tibetan versions of the Dhammapada, which are basically the same kind of thing as the Pali Dhammapada, but with quite a lot of different varying verses in it, but the same kind of thing. You know, the books in the Khuddaka Nikaya are books like the Jatakas, the Udana, the Itiwuttaka, and so on. So it seems like there might be some authentic material there, but the collections themselves were finalized later. The other major collection, of course, is the Abhidhamma. Now, whereas when we compare the two Vinayas and the many sets of Vinaya and the suttas, we find that they are largely similar with a few divergences. With the Abhidhamma, the situation is the reverse. They're largely divergent with a few similarities. So it's as certain as we can be that the Abhidhammas are largely a product of the sectarian period. In fact, what the Abhidhamma is they are a collection and systematization of the early teachings from the perspective of the various schools. So the Theravadan school would collect all the early teachings, develop new theories and ideas around that, and collect them in books and present them in a systematic form, which it called its Abhidhamma. The Sarvastivadin school also did the same thing, and we have, just as seven books in the Pali Abhidhamma, we have seven books in the Sarvastivadin Abhidhamma, preserved in Chinese translation. We also have one book of the Dharmaguptaka Abhidhamma. As I said, they are much more divergent, but there are some very significant similarities between them, and the most significant is a particular list and treatment of doctrinal topics, which is found in all three early Abhidhammas. That list forms the basis for the Pali book called the Vibhanga. I'll be coming back to this book later on. The Vibhanga has a series of chapters with very familiar doctrinal topics. The khandhas, the five aggregates, the ayatanas, six sense bases, the nidana, dependent origination, the satya, the four noble truths, dhatu, the elements, the indriyas, and then the various groups that make up what we call the bodhipakkhya dhammas. So again, I'll introduce you to some of these terms, even if you're not familiar with them, because I'll be using them later. Bodhipakkhya Dhammas is a very important list which is common to all of the schools, and it's seven groups of dhammas. So I hope in the sutta classes and so on they've probably been introduced to these at some stage. The seven groups are the four right efforts, the four satipatthanas, the four bases of psychic power, the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven enlightenment factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? These were grouped together from a very early stage and are found countless times in all of the schools of Buddhism, and they're a very, very important fundamental doctrinal topic. And these form the scaffolding for the discussion of the path in the Vibhanga. Now the same topics are also found in the Sarvastivadin book called the Dharmaskandha, and it has basically the same list of topics, often even quoting passages from the suttas on those topics. Basically what these books do is they collect passages from the suttas, the most important passages from the suttas on those doctrines, quote them, and then add some, often just defining the words in them. So they'll just say this word means that, that word means that, and list a whole series of synonyms for them. There's not much to them than that. Abhidhamma has a somewhat undeserved reputation for being incredibly complicated and difficult and forbidding. Actually, it's pretty simple once you sort of understand what's going on. It's just collecting a list of doctrinal terms and then combining these lists in various ways. There's not actually much intellectual content in it. And this similar teachings are also found in the Shariputra Abhidharma of the Dharmaguptaka school. And so it seems very likely that this particular schedule or list of doctrinal topics was the first Abhidhamma, which was belonged to the pre-sectarian period, was common to all of the schools. In other words, when the early Buddhists decided, let's get the most important doctrines, the most important passages, the most important teachings, collect them all together in a systematic form in one place, this is the first book that they came up with, and that formed the basis for these Abhidhamma works. Okay? So that's enough for now. That's maybe the first half of the talk. So maybe if we have a break for about 10 minutes, yeah, give you time to absorb, and then come back if you're ready, if you're gluttons for some more punishment. Okay? And it's actually quite a good idea to have a break in a Dhamma talk sometimes, because people are usually more relaxed when they come back. Yeah. Okay. So far, as I mentioned before, the stuff which I've been talking about so far is, for the most part, accepted by most of the scholars. I haven't been saying anything which is particularly controversial. I might just mention here, just to finish this talk up, just for your benefit, somebody asked before about the Mahayana. So just to briefly mention, the Mahayana appeared about 500 or something years after the Parinibbana. Nobody really knows where or exactly when or how. But they were largely it seems like they were most directly derived from the Mahasanghika school. But in fact, most of their theory of Mahayana is actually more closely derived from the Sarvastivada. In fact, usually they take the Sarvastivada and Abhidhamma and use that as their basic scaffolding and launch some kinds of philosophical critiques against that. So they reinterpret it, but they're still using the basic same stuff. It's important to remember that, because when you read in Mahayana Sutras, when they are criticizing what they call Hinayana, okay, they're not talking about Theravada and they're not talking about the early suttas. They're talking about Sarvastivada and Abhidhamma. Now, if you have never heard of Sarvastivada and Abhidhamma and you haven't got the faintest clue what's contained in there, you would wonder how relevant are these criticisms. And that's very true. A lot of those criticisms just simply aren't relevant in the context of the early suttas. Where Amida Buddha and Pure Land, there's two or three early suttas of the Mahayana, so let's say about the time of Christ, something like that, and describing Amitabha and the Pure Land. It doesn't seem like Amitabha worship was that popular or important in Indian Buddhism, although it does derive from Indian Buddhism. I have heard that I was once, when I was in Ipoh, I was sitting together with Paok Sayadaw and Venerable Dhamma Wudho, and Paok Sayadaw actually asked the same question. He said to Venerable Dhamma Wudho, where did this Amitabha stuff come from? And Dhamma Wudho said that there had been some research published in Chinese, which hasn't been put into English, which apparently concludes that Amitabha was originally a Persian sun god. Yeah? Which is actually extremely plausible, because that's where all the monotheistic religions came from. And, the Vedic, the ancient Indian pantheon of gods was the same as in ancient Persia and also ancient Greece and Rome. So there's no reason why a sun god shouldn't have moved from one place to the other. so it seems like that's probably the origins of it. Okay, so now we're going to move on to some more challenging and controversial stuff. There's a Chinese scholar monk called Yin Shun, who is very well known in, he's Taiwanese actually. He has done very extensive research into these kinds of questions. He passed away a couple of years ago and published a number of books on it. And in particular, he did some very interesting work based on a late text called the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, Yoga, meaning like in this case, meaning like meditation. Chara means life or living. Bhumi, the plane. Sastra is the treatise, so the treatise on the plane of meditation practice. Yogacara was one of the two great schools of Indian Mahayana. And this is a kind of monumental treatise of that school, which might be comparable to the Theravada Visuddhimagga in terms of its function within that school, a very authoritative compendium. Written about 500 AD, attributed to a fellow called Asanga. Now, this Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, a large proportion of it consists of a commentary on the Sanyukta Agama. So this is the version of the Sanyutta Nikaya from the Sarvastivadin school. And Yin Shun has demonstrated in detail that this version that was commented on in the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra is in fact the Sanyukta Agama, which is preserved in Chinese translation and which we have available today. Not only that, he also showed that the version in the Chinese canon was substantially disorganized. Over the years, it had become corrupted. The suttas, which were originally collected by topic, became scattered in different places. And so Yin Shun was able to take the commentary in the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra and actually reconstruct the original structure of the Sanyukta Agama. Not necessarily the original structure, but anyway, the structure that was valid in 500 AD. And that is considered so authoritative that it's actually been re-included in the latest edition of the Chinese Tripitaka, the Foguang edition, has accepted Yin Shun's work in that particular regard. Now, Yin Shun made a number of other interesting findings. The Yogacara Bhumi Shastra says that the Sanyutta was the foundation for all the other agamas. So this is a very interesting statement, the idea being that the Sanyutta was the fundamental collection of Buddhist scriptures from which all the other collections were derived. And he goes on to say that that fundamental collection consisted of three parts or three angas called Sutta, Gaya and Vyakarana. Now remember I mentioned before that there's this ninefold classification of the teachings. And the first three of those are Sutta, Gaya and Vyakarana. Now, almost all modern scholars will say that these nine classifications are not actual books. They're not collections of texts. They are genres of literature. Okay, they are literary styles, and that they weren't actually all collected together in one place. Yin Shun said that that's a mistake, and that they were, in fact, individual works or collections of those titles. That's certainly how it was interpreted by the traditions. Yeah. In fact, both the Brahmanical and the Jaina traditions also have collections that are called angas. They use the same term. And in those traditions, the angas are always specific collections of actual texts. They're not just literary styles. So Yin Shun took very seriously these statements by the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. And his work has been followed up by a number of other scholars, particularly the author of the book I mentioned before, The Comparison of the Two Sanyuttas. And also his teacher is a fellow called Rod Bucknell, lives in Queensland. He was teaching at UQ, and I've had a lot of very long telephone conversations with Rod about all these matters. And so we've decided to take these findings of Yin Shun seriously and to ask what are the implications of this? What does it actually mean to say that the Sanyutta was the foundation and the other ones were derived from it? No, for all of them, for both versions, yeah. Yin Shun says that these collections of the three collections of the three angas, Sutta, Gaya and Vyakarana, was collected at the First Council, in his opinion, and that that's essentially what the Sanyutta is. This is what's interesting about this, because we know that this classification, the threefold classification, must be very early, because it's mentioned many times in the suttas themselves. I should have mentioned this before. The things called that we know of today, for example, the Nikayas, the Tripitaka, all these kinds of words don't occur in the early suttas themselves. So the suttas themselves never refer to the Majjhima Nikaya, they never refer to the Tripitaka, these kinds of things, but they do refer to these ninefold angas. So this ninefold anga must be earlier must be an earlier classification system. It's also preserved in the Chinese and the Northern traditions, but they usually have 12 angas with the addition of three later ones. I won't go into detail about all of the other later angas. That would take me too far away from the main topic. Anga just means part. Yeah. So when we look at the existing Samyutta, we can see that it consists... The easiest portion to deal with is a book called the Saggatawagga, which is currently the first book in the Pali Samyutta. And both the Chinese and the Pali traditions say that Gaya Anga was the Saggatawagga of the Samyutta Nikaya. So we have a concordance of both the traditions. Yeah? So there's a very strong reason for accepting that. As far as Sutra and Vyakarana, we don't have such strong support from the traditions, but there are some hints here and there. In any case, what I've concluded, and the kind of the hypothesis I'm working on, is that Sutta means Sutta and Vyakarana are the prose discourses, the prose teachings. Okay. They are differentiated in the following ways. The suttas are spoken only by the Buddha. Okay? Vyakarana is spoken either by the Buddha or by disciples. Suttas are brief doctrinal statements. Vyakaranas are explanations and more detailed teachings. Suttas are in declarative form. So that means when the Buddha sits down and says, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, and so on, that's a sutta. But when a certain monk approaches the Buddha and says, what, Lord, is suffering? And the Buddha explains it, then this is a Vyakarana. So these are some of the most important differences. And these differences are adhered to fairly consistently through the Pitakas, if you look at it. For example, you almost never find a disciple sitting down and just giving a direct teaching. Okay? You almost never find that. The disciple will almost always give a teaching in terms of question and answer format, which is Vyakarana. Yeah? So these direct teachings, the suttas, is the province of the Buddha alone. Of course, there's always fuzzy edges in these things, okay? So it's never 100% clear-cut, but generally that holds pretty good. Now, when we look at the prose sections in the existing Samyuttas, we can see that they are largely organized in terms of a set of doctrinal categories, important doctrinal categories. That is to say, the most important Samyuttas are collected according to topic. Okay, so we'll choose a particular doctrinal topic. The Four Noble Truths, the Five Khandhas, the Six Sense Bases, the Elements, the Dependent Origination, and the various groups on the path. Now, the particular sequence of these chapters is different in the Pali and the Chinese version, but the actual chapters themselves are very similar. Okay, so it seems like this structure of the Samyutta must have existed before the schismatic period. Okay, so there was a collection of suttas, of discourses, according to topic, okay, collected before the schisms. Now, the other interesting thing is that these topics seem to correlate fairly well with the Four Noble Truths, okay? So one of the collections is the Four Noble Truths itself. Another one is the Khandhas and the Salayatana, the sense bases, which of course comes under the First Noble Truth. We have Dependent Origination, which is the Second and Third Noble Truths, and we have the ones on the path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. So this suggests to us that this was a scheme devised around the whole overarching structure was the Four Noble Truths, and that topics were collected underneath that overarching umbrella. As I mentioned before, in some of the one of the schools say that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta was the first discourse spoken. Now, spoken at the Second Council. Now that discourse, of course, largely deals with the Four Noble Truths. Now there are, in fact, no less than 17 versions of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, yeah, available. All the Vinayas have them, all the suttas have them, the Chinese, the Tibetan, Sanskrit, and so on. We've got 17 versions, and all of them talk about the Four Noble Truths. So there's a very good reason for thinking based on not just what the tradition tells us, but also on the concordance of all the texts of all the schools and all the traditions, that this was in fact probably the earliest sutta spoken by the Buddha. In the Pali, this sutta, despite its importance, is tucked away in a very obscure position. It's in the third collection, the Samyutta Nikaya. It's in the 52nd book within the third collection, and it's sutta number 11. Now, that's an extremely odd place to put such an important discourse. But, of course, 11 is a somewhat suspicious number, because in the early suttas, they're structured usually in terms of groups of 10, like there's a group called a vagga, which is like a chapter of 10 discourses. And it's fairly easy for a vagga to move from one place to another. Yeah? So what seems very likely, because it's number 11, that another vagga of 10 was put there beforehand. In fact, in the Chinese, it is number 1. Okay? So the Dhammacakka was probably number 1 in its particular chapter. The Samyutta Nikaya, according to the Sarvastivadin school, was listed the first of the four agamas. Yeah? It was like listed first, whereas we usually list the Digha first. So it seems very likely that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta should have been the first discourse in the first chapter of the first collection. Yeah? So we can literally accept what the Sarvastivadin tradition told us, that it was the first discourse spoken at the first council, and that the whole collection was organized in order to follow that scheme of the Four Noble Truths as taught in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So we've got like that whole overarching structure, and all of the suttas were fitted somewhere in that structure. So that's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah? That tells us that the people who put the canon together weren't quite as scatterbrained as they appear to be. Because if you look at the existing canons, we see just all this stuff everywhere and we can't make any sense out of it. In fact, it seems like it was actually very logical, very rational. They got the Dhammacakka, the first sutta, for number 1, and they organized everything according to the Four Noble Truths. Another interesting point here is that if we look at the accounts in the Vinaya of the Buddha's enlightenment and first teachings, we see a number of teachings that he's associated with. One in particular is the one that's called the Invitation of Brahma. Yeah, you know, when Brahma came down and said, please teach for the benefits of all beings. Now that's included in the Vinayas of the schools, and it's also included in the Saggata Vagga of the Samyutta Nikaya. Yeah? Which is quite interesting, isn't it? It's in both of those traditions, so it's probably common to those traditions from the time before the Vinaya and the Suttas split up. It was probably common knowledge to all of the monks in that time. Similar with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, it was common to the Vinayas and the Suttas. Similar with the second discourse, the discourse on not self and the fire sermon. They deal with the five aggregates and the six sense bases. They are also found in the Samyutta Nikaya. Yeah? They are the first discourses, and they have all of them are found specifically in the Samyutta Nikaya. And I don't know whether anyone has really noticed the significance of that before. Probably these are literally the first discourses and were in fact the literal historical seed that whole collection was crystallized around. So you get the first discourse, and then that's expanded into the five aggregates, the six sense bases, which become like the themes for whole chapters and collections in the Samyutta Nikaya. And also the Eightfold Path is mentioned there, so that becomes the seed of the whole collection of suttas on the path. So you have this very nice continuity between the different layers and strata of the teachings. And another interesting thing I mentioned before about the earliest Abhidhamma being like the concordance of these three Abhidhamma books. Now that also lists exactly the same list of doctrinal topics: the Four Noble Truths, the five aggregates, six sense bases, the elements, the path, the dependent origination, and so on, that are found as the titles of the chapters in the Samyutta Nikaya. And not only that, but many of the same discourses are actually taken straight out of the Samyutta and put into the earliest Abhidhamma. So this earliest Abhidhamma, which we can call the Vibhanga, the origin of the Vibhanga, was a collection of discourses primarily from the Samyutta and organized according to the same topics. So this is a very, very powerful finding. Yeah? This just tells us that we can trace a very, very strong, clear, and definite lineage of doctrinal historical doctrinal topics that were collected in this historical sequence, and that this was like the backbone of the Dhamma as collected in the earliest years. Of course, this gives rise immediately to the next question, which is how do these relate to the other Nikayas? Yeah, where do the other Nikayas come from? This is obviously a very complex question, so we can just offer a few suggestions about how that would have happened. If we look in the existing Pali Samyutta Nikaya, we see there are some omissions. There are some doctrinal topics which we would expect to find there, but we don't find. Probably the most important one is called the Sikha, the training. And of course you've all heard about the threefold Sikha, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, virtue, concentration and wisdom. Now, there's no collection of discourses in the existing Samyutta on the threefold Sikha, which is somewhat weird. Why not? The shorter discourses on the Sikha are currently included in the Anguttara Nikaya. The medium-length ones are included in the Majjhima Nikaya, and the long ones are in the Digha. Probably there was originally a Sikha Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya which collected all those together, but it got too big. It became too unwieldy, so it was broken up and moved into those different collections. In the Chinese, it does indeed have a Sikha Samyutta which teaches the threefold training, so that preserves that remnant there, which has been lost in the Pali. Generally speaking, actually, the Chinese Samyutta, especially the reconstructed form of it, seems to be more archaic, more structurally archaic than the Pali, okay? More authentic. Not as far as the teachings go, but as far as the structure and organization goes. More reliable, yeah, deriving from an earlier period. Yeah, the reconstructed Chinese Samyutta. For example, the Chinese version has much less repetitions than the Pali does. It seems like a lot of these repetitions which you find in the Pali, where they sort of get, you know, the basic teaching and then run it through many different variations in a very mechanical way, they're not found in the Chinese. So it seems like that was a particular fetish of the Theravadan school for some reason, that they just liked to do that. I don't know why. Yeah. Right. Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, certainly that would, you know, we would understand to some degree, but the Theravada seems to just take it to an extreme. I think it's a bit neurotic, personally. I think they were a bit kind of terrified that the teachings were going to disappear, so they sort of went a bit over the top and actually preserving them. But instead of actually preserving it, it just kind of fossilized it. In some kinds of repetition, yeah. It depends on the particular, the manner of repetition. For example, I mean, the ones I'm talking about now, specifically like in the Samyutta, for example, you have what they call the Ganga Payala, the Ganges repetition series, yeah? And that sort of addenda passage at the end of the Samyutta with all these kind of variations. So they're absent from the Chinese. And other things like that, rather than the internal repetitions as such, which I think was what you're referring to there. yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, repetition within a particular sutta. So, as opposed to repetition of whole suttas. The repetition of whole suttas in that case. Not saying completely absent, but that very mechanical form where you'll get a particular whole sutta and then repeat it according to some formula, it tends to be much less in the Chinese than in the Theravada. Okay? I've lost where I was now. What was I talking about? Sorry, repetitions, structure of the Samyutta and the Chinese. This Chinese version tends to be more structurally archaic. Yeah, I can't remember what point I was making though. Oh, yes, okay. So how we get from the Sanyutta to the other Nikayas. Okay, that's where we were. So one very interesting example here, well, a fairly simple, straightforward one, is the Digha. Now, at the beginning of the Digha Nikaya, we have a group of 10 suttas. Now, there's 12 or 13 in Pali. In fact, a couple of them are just meaningless repetitions. The Chinese has 10, and that was certainly more authentic. We have 10, which is the classic number of avagga. I mentioned this before, like a unit of suttas is avagga. That avagga is called the sila khanda, like the mass of sila. And in fact, each sutta includes a long section on the silas, the modes of conduct appropriate for the monks, okay? Specifically on monastic sila. In fact, it seems like this section on the sila was like the code of monastic conduct before there was a legalistic vinaya system. Okay, this was like the original code of conduct for the monks. Now that's a group of 10. It seems very likely that, in fact, that was the original seed around which the Digha was formed. That group of 10 is also found in the Chinese, also with all those 10 suttas together. The rest of the suttas in the Chinese are scattered here and there. They're not found all in the same place. In the Pali and the Chinese, they're found together. So it was like a unit. The other thing we also find is we have lists of the contents of the Dighas of two other schools. That is the Sarvasivadin and the Mula Sarvasivadin. The suttas don't exist, but we have the list of contents. They both include the same group of 10 suttas, the Silakanda group. And they also include only another 6. So those, it seems like the Sarvasivadin Digha Nikaya was only 16 suttas. Those other 6 are the Mahapadana Sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Dasottara Sutta, the Sangiti Sutta, which are all in the Pali and Chinese, and also 2 which are not. One is called the Chatusparisat Sutta on the 4 assemblies. And that seems like it was probably very similar to the first chapter of the Vinaya Mahavagga, telling the story of the Buddha's enlightenment and how he converted the 4 assemblies and established the Sangha. The last one is one called the Arthavistara, which literally means the meaning in detail, and nobody knows what that was. So we have 16, and we have that same group of 10, and we've authorized that for 4 schools, yeah? So that's pretty good. That seems like that was like a core group of teachings in that. Some of the others are not found. I mean, one of the interesting findings which I've come across, which is going to cause a bit of a kerfuffle, I'm afraid, is that the Maha Satipatthana Sutta is not found in any of those Digha Nikayas. And in fact, it seems as certain as we can that the Maha Satipatthana Sutta was a very late interpolation into the canon, perhaps 300 to 400 years after the Buddha passed away. So I'm sure I'm not going to make myself popular by publishing these findings. Anyway, so what seems likely here is we had an original, as I mentioned before, Sikkha Sanyutta in part of the Sanyutta Nikaya. It was broken up. The long ones became the original Digha, which is probably just the 10 suttas, and then they attracted other long discourses to form that long collection. The middle ones went into the Majjhima. In the Majjhima, we can also discern certain kinds of structural elements derived from the Sanyutta. In fact, the Chinese has a number of chapters which are actually called Sanyutas. We have the Raja Sanyutta Vagga and the Kama Sanyutta Vagga and so on. Chapters which are actually called Sanyutas and which are dealing with topics which are found in the existing Sanyutas. Yeah? So they were probably originally chapters within the Sanyutta moved over to the Majjhima. In the Pali, for example, we have another one, the Salayatana Vagga. Again, 6 sense bases, which is a topic treated in the Sanyutta. We have 10 suttas in the Pali, okay, all dealing with that same topic. In the Chinese, they're all found in the Sanyutta. Okay, so it seems like sometime after the schism, they were moved out of the Sanyutta and into the Pali Majjhima. In the Chinese, they stayed where they were in the Sanyutta. So these are the kinds of movements that we're talking about. Obviously, not all of it is so neat and tidy. Yeah, the suttas, the existing collections are very complex, and it's not easy to explain everything according to this theory, but it does give us at least a perspective. We've got somewhere to stand. We've got a starting place. We can then kind of look at the different scriptures and so on and evaluate them. And this becomes a very important and extremely useful method if we ever want to examine or study any of the teachings in the suttas. We have a framework. We can say, okay, let's look at a particular teaching. Is that found in these earliest discourses, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and so on? Is it found there? If not, is it found in the Samyutta? Where is it in the Samyutta? How is it treated there? How important is it? And so on. We can move from the Samyutta to the other collections regarding the Samyutta as being of somewhat greater authority than the later collections. The Pali version. In terms of structural matters, yes, that seems to be the conclusion. That's not an assumption, that's a conclusion. Yeah. You can't necessarily rely on it, but you can use it as implied by a lot of different bits and pieces. Even Bhikkhu Bodhi notices that in the introduction to his Samyutta, that the Chinese Agamas relate more closely to the Four Noble Truths than the Pali does. In fact, he was using the unreconstructed Samyutta. The reconstructed one is even closer to the Four Noble Truths. So that's one we've got. There are quite a lot of others that I could go into, different points here and there. Another one, for example, the Pali, we have a collection called the Bhikkhu Samyutta. The Bhikkhu Samyutta is about 12 or 13 suttas. Most of them, 10 of them, have verses. Now, as suttas with verses, they should really belong in the Saggata Wagga, which is a collection with verses. But they're not, they're outside of it. In the Chinese, they are in the Saggata Wagga, and that seems much more rational idea. In fact, in the existing Pali, what happened is that the Saggata Wagga is the number one, first book. The second book is the Nidana, the Nidana Wagga. And the Bhikkhu Samyutta is the last one in the Nidana Wagga. Yeah? What seems very likely is that some monk was a bit unmindful in the monastic library one time and misfiled it, so that actually the Bhikkhu Samyutta belongs here and not there. And the Bhikkhu Samyutta should actually be the first one of the Saggata Wagga, and that they simply put the book back in the wrong place, and that it got taken out and put at the end there. Well, again, this is not just a kind of a priori reasoning, but there is an existing text, the Chinese version, which does actually have that system. And in the Chinese version, the bhikkhu is actually first. Okay, there are also other factors regarding, for example, the internal consistency of the particular topics within the Saggata Wagga. That is, we say, for example, you have a Bhikkhu Samyutta, you also have a Bhikkhuni Samyutta in the Saggata Wagga. So they would seem to be a pair. It would seem to be logical if you've got a Bhikkhuni Samyutta, you should also have a Bhikkhu Samyutta. But in Pali, of course, it's missing from that collection. So that's another reason for thinking that. Another point is in the, with that particular one, there is a Pali commentary. Now, in all of the Pali commentaries, at the beginning of each of the commentary, with the first sutta in each collection, it will give a particular description of how and why suttas are given. Okay, so it will say suttas are given for these reasons. Someone will come and ask the Buddha to give a talk. Sometime he'll give a talk because of some particular incident. Sometime he'll give a talk spontaneously, and so on. So there's a stock passage in the commentaries that's included with the first sutta of each collection. Okay. So it'll say these are the general reasons why he might give any discourse, and then this is the particular reason in this discourse. Okay. Now, in every other collection, that's in the first sutta. In the Pali, that's in the first sutta of the Nidana Samyutta. Yeah? So that again suggests that at the time of the commentaries, or at the time that passage was composed, the Nidana Samyutta was also the first sutta in the was also the first part of the Samyutta Nikaya. So these are the kinds of reasons that we're using. So your point is very good, that none of these are hard and fast. You know, we're never able to lay black and white and say it must have been like this. There's a lot of supposition and a lot of room for error. What we have to try to do is look for as many different kinds of criteria as possible and try to add them up, being as independent as possible. When we find two or three indications all pointing in the same direction, then that's going to multiply our faith in those conclusions. Of course, we have to come back to the problem. We have these collections. They obviously do derive from a common source, and yet they obviously are substantially different. So how do we explain that? At the moment, we don't really have much of an explanation. No one's able to tell us very much about actually why are they related in this way, what was that original collection, how did they come to be divergent. So what we're trying to do is to answer those questions. So we have to find some kind of answer, and these are the only criteria so far that we have to do that. So, but yeah, we just have to keep on checking as much as we can as we go along. Yeah. So it's still very much in the stage of kind of throwing up hypotheses and ideas and sort of grinding it through the machine and seeing what comes out in the end. Yeah. Sometimes you get some very spectacular results. Sometimes you can think, for example, one of the techniques I used quite recently I was studying the Satipatthana Samyutta. Now, there's a collection of 50 suttas in the Pali dealing with Satipatthana. I won't go into this in too much detail, but just to give you an idea of the methods. I said, well, okay, let's look at these 50 suttas. Let's take all those suttas that look as if they're probably artificial, that could have been constructed out of just multiplying some stock formulas and rehashing some old bits and pieces found from everywhere else. Let's take all those ones and throw them out and see what we've got left, okay? And we left with about 26 suttas. So then I put them to one side and I said, well, let's take the Chinese and the Pali, okay, and put them together and see what do we get. Yeah, we also get about 26 suttas, and they're almost all the same suttas as we found using the other method, only about two or three suttas that are not the same. So using two completely independent methods, we came up with the same list of suttas, which I would conclude was like the composition of the Satipatthana Samyutta before the schism. Yeah. So again, this is the kinds of methods that we can use. Hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it could be any number of reasons, but I guess, you know, we have to give those people the benefit of the doubt. They thought they were doing the right thing, and what they thought they were doing was making the meaning of the text clearer and so on. So remember, in these, a lot of these issues, it doesn't actually affect the actual specific teachings so much. Yeah. Now we can get a certain sutta on Satipatthana. Let's say it teaches the four Satipatthanas. We have the stock formula. Now we can then multiply that out a dozen times, 2,000 times, and say that this Satipatthana leads to the ending of craving. And then we can say it leads to the ending of conceit. And then we can say it leads to freedom from suffering. And then we can say it leads to whatever. We can multiply that as many times as we like. Actually, it doesn't make much difference to the actual doctrine. So, you know, for example, in that case, with the 50 suttas in the Satipatthana Samyutta, I reduced it to half. But actually, it didn't actually change the teachings. What it did was it focused on those suttas which were meaningful rather than those suttas which were just kind of extra, extra kind of flab on the whole collection. Hmm. See that? Yes. Hmm. Okay, so the question is whether the Vinaya is an explanation of the material found in the Sila Khanda, which was giving like the conduct of the bhikkhus, or not. Not really. The Vinaya is somewhat separate, although it obviously includes a lot of the same kinds of material. The Sila Khanda that I referred to in the Digha Nikaya is largely an elaboration on the 10 precepts of the novice. Okay? So it has 3 sections. The first one basically gives the 10 precepts with a small amount of elaboration. The second section gives much more elaboration. And the third section deals with right livelihood for monks. The Vinaya itself probably originated sometime later than that. So this was probably taught by the Buddha from the beginning of the sasana. And it wasn't like a legal system. It wasn't like him saying, you have to do this, and if you do that, then this is this, you have this penalty, you have these procedures and things like that. It was like, let's praise this particular mode of conduct, mode of life, which we regard as the best way of life, and let's encourage and exhort the bhikkhus to aspire to this. Yeah? And that's how in the beginning, you know, people were well behaved, well practiced, and they would do that. Later on, it became necessary to establish the Vinaya rules, and with particular, you know, legal frameworks and classes of offences and precedents and all these kinds of things. So that the first Vinaya rule was established maybe 10 or 20 years into the Buddha's career. It's like a separate document, a separate literary tradition to that Sila Kanda, although many of the same rules apply: not to kill, not to steal, not eating afternoon, not handling money. These kinds of things are always found in both. The Vinayas of all the traditions are very, very similar, but I think we're likely to find when the Vinayas have, of course, the list of monks' rules, okay, Parimokkha, then and elaborations of those, okay, explanations, background stories, cases, and so on. We're likely to find, when the background work has been done, which it hasn't been done yet, we're likely to find that there's much more divergence in that material, the explanatory matter, than there is in the actual rules themselves. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Yeah. Next time, Kanchan. Lim? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe gives me greater faith in the principles and less kind of insistence on the details. And certainly, you know, the more I study this, and the more you gain this perspective, you know, you can see that this is just the teachings of the Buddha. And it's not the teachings of the schools. And it's a very important context to make. And it's if you haven't really studied it in some depth, it's very difficult to appreciate. I mean, these days I just can't really call myself a Theravadin anymore. I mean, it's just completely meaningless to me. For me, Theravada started 200 years after the Buddha and is encapsulated in certain Abhidhamma books and commentaries, which I find... Well, there's some things worthwhile in there, but I find a lot of the stuff's quite dubious. Yeah, and that's not what I identify with. The stuff I love and which I identify with is the teachings of the Buddha that he taught himself in the Suttas and Vinaya. And, you know, we can find those same teachings in the Chinese canon just as we can in the Pali canon. So how are we, you know, justified to say that's Theravada? Actually, it's got nothing to do with Theravada. Four Noble Truths has got nothing to do with Theravada, the Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, and so on. These weren't inventions by the Theravadan school. It's just that we happen to have the particular textual tradition that was passed down by the Theravada school. That's all. Yeah. Kanchana? Possibly, yeah. At least in the pre-sectarian period, it might have started up in the Buddha's lifetime himself. There's references to the word Abhidhamma occurs a couple of times, and it seems to refer to something like the same collection. There's another word called Matika, which is like the list of doctrinal topics, and again was probably those topics which again the khandhas, ayatanas, dhatus, dependent origination, and the Bodhipakkhya dhammas. That was probably what the earliest Abhidhamma, and that may have happened or started to happen in the Buddha's lifetime. Okay, so that's a good question. If the basic doctrinal teachings in the Sanyutta and the Abhidhamma are essentially similar, the earliest Abhidhamma here, why then would why bother creating an early Abhidhamma? To understand that, I think you have to look at the nature of those collections. Now let's look at a collection like the Nidana Sanyutta. The first sutta of the Nidana Sanyutta gives the 12 factors of dependent origination. The second sutta is called Vibhanga, okay? Vibhanga meaning analysis. And what that, so the dependent origination says ignorance causes blah, 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 and mentions each of the factors. So we have ignorance, sankharas, vijnana, and so on. The Vibhanga Sutta then says, what is ignorance? Ignorance is not knowing the Four Noble Truths. What is sankharas? And it defines each term. Okay? Now, most of the important doctrines have this kind of sutta, which we can call as a Vibhanga Sutta. Often it's actually called Vibhanga. So we have a Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, we have a Satcha Vibhanga Sutta, and so on. Some of them don't, but most of them do. Most of the important doctrines have a Vibhanga Sutta. These Vibhanga Suttas are very important because they act like a key to the rest of the suttas. So, for example, with the Eightfold Path, the Buddha would have taught the Eightfold Path very often. Now, in those early collections, those Vibhangas then define what are all the factors of the Eightfold Path mean. So the Buddha, we don't have to repeat those definitions every time. We just list the factors of the Eightfold Path. When we want to know what that means, we turn to the Vibhanga Sutta, which is the key to those whole that whole collection. So what it seems like is that the earliest Abhidhamma was an effort to collect all those Vibhanga Suttas together as an overall key to understanding and interpreting the whole suttas. And that's a book called the, sensibly enough, the Vibhanga. Yeah? And so that would have been assembled in a much more coherent and convenient format. Now, unfortunately, what happened with the Vibhanga is that it then became a lot elaborated later on in peculiarly Abhidhamma ways, so that the work we have now is not actually as useful as it should have been. If you simply stuck to that original idea, which is common to all of the early Abhidhammas, get the sutta passages on the main topics and give the main explanatory discourse on that, it would actually be very useful. So the Vibhanga is in some ways possibly even more archaic than the material in the suttas in some respects. And one of the important respects here again is in Satipatthana. And the exposition of Satipatthana in the Vibhanga is much simpler than that found in the Theravadin Satipatthana Sutta. So this is another reason why I am alleging that the Satipatthana Sutta is essentially a forgery. The Mahasatipatthana Sutra is certainly later. Even the Satipatthana Sutra itself is substantially different. We have six early versions of that material, and each version is substantially different. For example, they'll have under body contemplation, they'll have a widely varying list of topics there. The sections on feeling and the mind are more or less the same. Section on dhammas, again, varies quite a bit. The only common factors are in the body contemplation, the 31 parts of the